loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Secretary of State John Kerry is traveling to Moscow today, where he will meet with Russia's foreign minister. The two are expected to discuss problems with the ceasefire agreement in Syria and Ukraine. Apple and the FBI go to court today in the battle over encryption. The government is using the San Bernardino terrorist attack to demand that Apple create a backdoor into every iPhone. Apple says, no way. Donald Trump's rallies are being met with resistance and protest everywhere he travels. With the Arizona primary taking place tonight, as well as the Utah caucus, we'll speak with one of the activists who attended the protest against Trump over the weekend and virtually shut it down. But first, we turn to John Kerry's visit to Moscow. We are joined in studio by Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst. He was a daily briefer for the President of the United States. He is a journalist and a critic of U.S. foreign policy. Welcome, Ray McGovern.
Thank you.
First, let me read from an official State Department announcement about the visit of Secretary of State John Kerry to Moscow. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will visit Moscow, Russia, March 22nd to 25th with Russian officials. They will discuss ongoing efforts of the International Syria Support Group to maintain the cessation of hostilities, provide aid, and improve and expand humanitarian access, and facilitate a political transition in Syria while also combating Daesh. That would be the so-called Islamic State. The secretary will also discuss Ukraine and the need for full implementation of the Minsk agreements. Now, Ray McGovern, John Kerry is meeting with the foreign minister, his counterpart, Lavrov. He's also asked for a meeting with Vladimir Putin. There's been no announcement yet about whether such a meeting will take place. From your point of view, why is Kerry going to Moscow once again?
His mission depends on who he's working for. I hope he's working for President Obama and not the neocons from whom he's taken orders in the past. This is really an interesting set of circumstances. We're 2.5 years past the almost war on Syria. Now, we know that Kerry participated in the effort to mousetrap Obama into making outward war on Syria, shock and awe. It was supposed to be the 31st of August or the 1st of September. It didn't happen because Obama was told that he was being mousetrapped, false flag, pure and simple. It didn't matter how many times Secretary Kerry said on the 30th of August at the State Department that Bashar al-Assad's government was responsible for the chemical attacks outside Damascus. He said it 35 times. Now, I have to say, Brian, that you don't have to be a Shakespearean scholar to remember, methinks he doth protest too much. He didn't have the evidence. And now even the president has told Jeffrey Goldberg that the head of national intelligence came to him that week and said, Mr. President, I know that the Secretary of State has been blaming this chemical incident on Bashar al-Assad, but you should know this time around that, let me put it this way, it's not a slam dunk, Mr. President. It's not a slam dunk. What does that mean? That means that what we knew at the time, because our friends were telling us, people still in the intelligence community, that the evidence about who did that chemical attack was very elusive. As a matter of fact, it pointed mostly to the rebels, and now we know virtually 90% sure it was the rebels. So what did Obama take from that? Well, he took a lesson about how much he could trust John Kerry. Let me just say one more word here. Kerry kept sort of pushing for war on Syria. He met with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee just a week later, about the 4th of September, and he was still plotting for war against Syria. So much so that that very day when President Obama arrived in St. Petersburg for a summit, he was greeted by Putin, and the next day Putin said about John Kerry, because of his Senate testimony about Bashar al-Assad being responsible for those chemical attacks, and because John Kerry had told those senators, the moderates have the upper hand now, the moderates are beginning to win, what Putin said about Kerry was on vriot, on znayet chto vriot, eto pechalnya, which means he's lying, he knows he's lying. This is really sad. What happened? Well, Putin and Obama took it upon themselves to work out an easy resolution here because they had been working with the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, to get his chemical weapons destroyed. Putin pulled Obama's chestnuts out of the fire. They were destroyed on American ships outfitted for that purpose.
But Ray, let me interrupt for a quick second, because I think you're... narrative is extremely important and extremely interesting. You're saying President Obama lost confidence, or at least learned not to trust John Kerry because he had, was mousetrapping him and taking him into a war that didn't need to happen and would have been a disaster and then didn't happen after Russia offered a face-saving way out, the destruction, first the monitoring and then the destruction of Syria's weapons of mass destruction, the chemical weapons or biological weapons. But here we have Kerry's back in Moscow now, and the Russians are very aware that the American government has changed its policy, has entered into, through Vienna and then Geneva, a process whereby there could be a cessation of hostilities, a political process, possibly a government of national unity that could come out of this after elections in perhaps 18 months. And right now, the Russians are complaining that the United States government refuses to do its part in joining in as a cooperative partner to make sure that the ceasefire violations are monitored or dealt with. And Russia has said, hey, if the United States isn't going to live up to its side of the agreement, we, Russia, will do it on our own. In other words, become the enforcer of the ceasefire. Do you think that Kerry's representing Obama? Do you think that Kerry... that the Obama administration has like little to really offer next in the process? Or what's going on right this moment?
Well, right this moment, it seems as though Kerry has gotten religion. Obama has given him tasks to do, and he's dutifully carried them out. This is in contrast to that earlier episode 2.5 years ago, when Kerry, on the 9th of September 2013, was still arguing that we had to take Assad out because of what he did with the chemical stuff. And he said in London, when somebody asked him, is there nothing that Bashar al-Assad can do to avoid an attack by the U.S.? He said, well, he could give up all those chemical weapons for destruction, but that's not going to happen. That's not in the cards. That very day, as Kerry was en route back to Washington, the announcement was made that his boss, Obama, and Putin had worked this arrangement out with the Syrians that they would destroy all the chemical weapons. When he came back, Obama said, now, John, sorry, we didn't tell you about this, but we've got a deal. Now go back to Geneva and finish it up. So that was his kind of call to Jesus, so to speak, all right? Now, since then, on the Iran thing and on this Russian military intervention into Syria, Kerry has been carrying out his instructions. Thank goodness, all right? But now what will he do? He's got the neocons, he's got the Saudis, he's got the Turks, he's got all these people that he's been listening to in the past, and they're telling him this is a bad deal. So a lot depends on Kerry, and Putin's not going to meet with Kerry unless he's assured that Obama is playing with straight cards now and is not going to defer to Kerry, as he almost did 2.5 years ago, and it almost started a war. He was the day away from pushing the button for the war. But
let me ask you, Ray McGovern. President Obama clearly was the voice of restraint as compared to Kerry, who, you know, he was the one who accepted the Russian offer. He was the one who punted when it came to that, you know, magic moment when he had to decide to bomb or let Congress decide, which, of course, meant a way to back away from bombing. Obama was.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's almost like Obama doesn't really direct the foreign policy until perhaps a crisis has come about and he made a decision to restrain Kerry and the neocons, the people you're talking about. But right now, it seems that President Obama has a lot vested in the success of the ceasefire in Syria. I mean, what would explain the United States not going all the way in terms of agreeing with the Russians that they too would monitor ceasefire violations? In other words, the ceasefire violations from the rebels that the United States has been supporting, that Kerry has been trumpeting all these years.
Well, I imagine, and this is a guess, that they'll work something out to allow bilateral enforcement of the cessation of hostilities. Bear in mind, it's not a ceasefire. The Russians are still going after ISIL. So are we, I believe. But there is the makings of a deal there. This all started when Obama met with Putin at the UN on the 28th of September last year. And Putin said, by the way, Mr. President, I thought I ought to tell you ahead of time, we're going to be bombing the hell out of ISIS in just 2 days. That's why we have all those aircraft. And so we hope that you'll cooperate with us rather than be at loggerheads with us. Now, to his credit, Obama said, all right, I'll have Kerry meet with Lavrov. We'll work it out. We'll deconflict the airstrikes, number one, and then we'll work something out. And so Kerry followed those instructions. He worked something out with Lavrov. They have something on very, very tangible in being now. The question is, why is it that the U.S., that Kerry, is kind of foot-dragging on the pledge to mutually enforce this cessation of hostilities? And I think one reason he's going to Moscow is because Putin has said to Obama, look, hey, you know, we have a deal here. People are still kind of diffident about it, still kind of bowing, kowtowing to the Saudis, the Turks, and the Qataris, and the Israelis. Now, that we're going to do this, or we're not going to do it? Would you please send Kerry here again? We want to talk Turkey to him. And I mean talk Turkey in both senses of the word.
The State Department's announcement about this trip, which I read in the beginning of our interview, I want to read one line again to emphasize it for you and to get your comment. It says about the purpose of the trip, it's to improve and expand humanitarian access and facilitate a political transition in Syria while also combating Daesh, which is the Islamic State, ISIL. In other words, in terms of order of priority, it appears, at least in terms of the way it's written, it's to facilitate the political transition in Syria, meaning eventually getting rid of Bashar Assad, while also, as a secondary goal, at least this is the way it's written, combating Daesh. In other words, is it possible that there's still a difference of opinion between the State Department and the White House in terms of emphasis on the Syria ceasefire?
Yes, you're right, Brian, to point that out. There's always been this difference. You see, the United States has more trouble with its allies, and I put allies in quotes because none of them except Turkey are real allies. I'm talking about the Turks. I'm talking about the Saudis, the Qataris. I'm talking about the Israelis. They don't want what's happening in Syria.
Meaning the ceasefire.
Yeah, the Israelis would just as soon have the Sunni and Shia kill each other off till the last person. They've said so, okay? The Turks want to replace Assad. So do the Saudis. So the question is, can Obama and hopefully Kerry persuade these people to knock it off? And so far, as we see through continuing ceasefire or cessation of hostilities violations, it's a tough slog. So the proof will be in the pudding. If Kerry brings a message to Moscow, look, we acknowledge our responsibility for these implacable people that want to get Bashar al-Assad removed. We're going to do ISIL or Daesh first, and then we're going to talk about Bashar al-Assad. Well, that's the way it's been for the last several months. That's the way it's been since the end of September when the Russian military intervention started. I suspect we'll continue that way. Just makes good sense. Even if you look at the Israelis, even if you look at the Turks, do they want ISIL? Do they want ISIS or the Islamic State taking over Syria and having access to the Mediterranean? I don't think even they want it. So there is the makings of a deal. I see this as a kind of a sounding out visit, because Obama's got a limited time left. I think he wants to achieve some things. The Iran deal was a major achievement, and working out this deal with the Russians on Syria was another major achievement. So maybe he's got some, what should we call them? Maybe he's got some guts now, all right? And he's telling Kerry, look, let's see if we can get Ukraine, for God's sake. Let us get Ukraine in order. Now, the fly in the ointment there, of course, is our surrogates in Kiev, who refused to abide by Minsk, who refused to set up the regional agreement that was agreed to by the people that did Minsk. And so if Kerry's willing to talk about that, well, he's got some explaining to do, because with all the influence the United States and NATO has in Kiev, they've not been able to persuade these puppets to do the right thing and carry out those provisions of the Minsk Agreement.
Ray McGovern, we have just under 2 minutes left. I want to also ask you, because you wrote an article when it was announced by the Russians. They announced unilaterally that their mission was largely accomplished. They were withdrawing a part of their military. They were, of course, retaining the military infrastructure and the air base and the naval base so that they could return, and they could return quickly. But you said Putin was gambling that their decision to withdraw might be like understood by Western powers like the United States, like the Obama administration, that the time was now to really come together and have some sort of meaningful ceasefire political process for a real end to the war. Do you think that the Obama administration at this point is committed to that?
There is no Obama administration. There's Obama, and there's these clowns that he has advising him on foreign policy. So the question is whether Obama will rise to the occasion, as he did on Iran, as he did when challenged by Putin on Russian intervention in Syria. And, you know, I'd hate to put money on that. He faces these people down every now and then, but usually it's just an inch short of war. So whether Kerry will follow his instructions, whether they will actually achieve progress not only on Syria but on Ukraine, that all is up in the air, remains to be seen.
We want to thank Ray McGovern. He's a former CIA analyst. He's a critic of U.S. foreign policy. His works can be found at raymcgovern.org, including his recent articles about U.S.-Russian relations and Russia's decision to withdraw from Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. Apple and the FBI go to court today in the battle over encryption. Apple has said that the demands of the government to unlock the phone belonging to one of the San Bernardino shooters accounts to being asked to build a backdoor to the iPhone and for iPhones everywhere. We are joined by Stephen Rombaum. He is a founder and CEO of the investigative agency Pelorium. And we are joined by Brian Ford. He is the associate professor at Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. Welcome, Stephen and Brian.
Thank you.
Stephen Rombaum, let's start with you. What's at stake and what's the main argument that Apple and the government are making? We have to kind of go briefly, so obviously you can't cover the full topic.
You know, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that this is one of the most important court cases and one of the most important events regarding personal privacy and government intrusion that's come down the road for the past 20 years. What's at stake here is whether personal information, and by personal information, I mean the most intimate personal information, who your friends are, what you do during the day, your health records, your finances, even extending into things like where you are, your politics, your sexual orientation, all of that will be open if the court comes down on the side of the government. This is not about a single case. This is about encryption and the individual's ability to keep things private. And I don't think that's hyperbole. You know, the government has been looking, and the FBI has been looking, and I think they're very upfront about this. They've been looking for a court case to decide the issue of encryption. for the past 20 years, dating back to the Clipper chip and things like that, the U.S. government has been trying to obtain legal ways to intercept communications and to eliminate the stronger and stronger and stronger encryption that's available to the average person. There's a saying that my friends who are prosecutors tell me that bad cases make bad laws. Well, the U.S. government is putting forward an argument that this is information regarding heinous terrorists, which it is, and as a result of that, Apple needs to develop a backdoor to its encryption, which will give the FBI access. It has to develop a modified operating system, a modified OS, which Apple is calling government OS, that will give the FBI access essentially to every single iPhone. This is a critical issue.
Let's bring Brian Ford in. Brian, Stephen is making the point that this was just not really about the San Bernardino case, that the government was looking for a highly emotional sort of landscape. And obviously a terrorist attack like the terrible attack that happened in San Bernardino has a lot of emotion associated with it. And it seems rational maybe to the average person who's not paying careful attention. Why wouldn't Apple want to catch the terrorists or other terrorists who might have been communicating with the terrorists who killed those people in San Bernardino? Do you agree with Stephen Rambam that this is really just, in a way, a pretext, that the government has been seeking to do this? And if so, what is the danger? Do you agree with him about the magnitude of this in terms of privacy protection?
Yes, I completely agree with Stephen. So the FBI accuses Apple of using this case as a marketing ploy. Actually, I think from all the signs I see, it's actually the FBI who's using this as a very clever marketing ploy to try to sell back doors to the public. And, you know, as Stephen says, this is an enormously important issue. There's no way this is about just one iPhone. For example, you know, like I said, all of the evidence of the case, the fact that the killers actually had this is the iPhone in question is not the killers' actual personal phones. They actually destroyed their personal phones. The iPhone in question is the phone that they did not bother to destroy. There's no evidence that has appeared publicly that there is likely to be anything of investigative value on the phone in question. It just so happened to be the particular phone that the FBI got to use to play the terrorism card to try to, you know, convince the public to support its desire for broad backdoors on Apple devices. So, you know, that's my interpretation, but I'm pretty sure a lot of security experts would agree.
You know, let me be clear about one thing. I'm an investigator, and I routinely work on the prosecution side. I'm the guy who works to put people in jail as a rule. And I'm certainly not opposed to reasonable search warrants and reasonable access to information. I think it would be an outrageous step in the other direction if we had a situation where no communications were accessible by reasonable law enforcement request. But what the FBI is doing here is they are throwing the baby out with the bathwater. They want access essentially to all iPhones. They did not craft a warrant, or I should say a court pleading, where they're saying, we're giving this phone to Apple, and Apple will obtain access only to this phone and will turn over the information to us. You know, Apple has provided access to law enforcement around the world to tens of thousands of iPhones. Apple isn't opposed, and I don't think any reasonable person believes that terrorists' communication should be secure, quite the opposite. But what the government is trying to do is you look up the word overreach in the dictionary and you see this court case. Had the government crafted something a little more intelligently, it would be a different story. But what the government is trying to do pretty outrageously is destroy all encryption and obtain access to all communication devices. And that's where I split company with them. I'm very, very pro-law enforcement, but I think it's possible to be pro-law enforcement and pro-privacy at the same time.
Facebook, Google, and Microsoft are among the companies that have filed briefs with the court showing support for Apple. How are the other companies impacted? Brian?
Well, I think this is this case is hugely important for basically all the major tech companies, and you know it's you know I completely understand, you know, I'm very glad that they're throwing their support for Apple, because you know if Apple loses this case, you know the biggest harm is it could set a precedent that basically that will have repercussions to all tech companies, basically forbidding, you know, tech companies from deploying strong encryption, as Stephen pointed out. And, you know, this could be basically the end of legal encryption for the good guys, for the rest of us who just want to buy products. It will not be the end of encryption for the bad guys, because, you know, any smart terrorist will then just go buy or run open source encryption software from somewhere else in the world. And there's plenty of other places they can get strong encryption. They just won't be able to, you know, so it won't affect the bad guys that much. It will mainly affect the rest of us.
Stephen Rambam, I want to go back and you can jump in, but I just want to go back to something that I think Brian said too, which I think the public really doesn't grasp at all right now, which is that this phone isn't the phone. It's not that important. And that the entire thing has been a smoke and mirrors game in the media to make people feel or think that Apple, by refusing to give access to this phone, is depriving the government of absolutely necessary information to stop a future terrorist attack. I want to emphasize that again, if that's in fact true. And also the other question, the NSA collects data on everything and everybody, and they listen to and retain the data on everything and what everybody says or writes. Wouldn't they have all of this information through other programs?
You know, I wish we had a show today that was about five times as long, because there's so many critically important issues that dovetail with this particular case. You know, not to channel Donald Rumsfeld, but you don't know what you don't know until you know it. There's no way to know what's on this phone. Pretty much the only DOJ argument that I agree with in their pleadings is there's no way to know what's on this phone. This phone was in the possession of the terrorists. It might have critical location data that once they pull it up might show a meeting with another individual. There might be a text. There might be a search file, you know, a cache of searches that would lead to something else. You just don't know. In general, I strongly support the government's desire to access this one phone, because you don't know what's going to be on the phone. And a good investigator follows every lead without exception. What I don't agree with is the government's attempt to bust all encryption. And the comment about depriving everyone of the rights, I think this is a case that's really analogous to the firearms debate. You know, good folks, honest folks, law-abiding folks will be deprived of that right, and bad people will still go out and avail themselves of the right. I think it's absolutely correct that encryption will be busted on iPhones, and the bad people will still use PGP, and they will still use Telegram, and they will still use other methods. You know, people really need to keep their eye on the ball. For most people, they've turned on with the iPhone, they've turned on iCloud backup. So the average person has already deprived himself of the security that's possible with an iPhone. This is an issue that somehow has been submerged by this debate. You know, when you talk about Google and Microsoft jumping in and filing friend of the court briefs, any knowledgeable person has to laugh. The truth is that Google and Apple and Microsoft and Amazon and every other large company out there is primarily a marketing company. And what they are marketing is your information. If I had a choice as an investigator to have unrestricted access to every government database or unrestricted access to every private database, I and every other detective out there would choose private databases. Google and Apple and Facebook know exponentially more about the average individual than the government does.
Well, Brian Ford, with that said, which sounds right to me, what then really is the reason Facebook, Google, and Microsoft are joining with Apple, have filed amicus briefs, friends of the court brief, in order to show support for Apple? And I want to also ask you, if you could, where do you think the case is going? Do you think that in the face of this kind of government offensive where Apple's being portrayed as like the friend of terrorists now, that Apple can still succeed in the court case? They've lost at the lower court. Will it eventually go to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, so for the first question, I think Google and Microsoft and the other companies are in support of Apple in part because they see this as their freedom to the government is trying to threaten their freedom to build the products with the security mechanisms they believe is good for them and for their users. Now, Apple happens to be quite far ahead in a lot of the security mechanisms they built in their iPhones. They're ahead of many of the others, but we know that that Google has been following and deploying increasingly strong protections in their Android phones. They're definitely not farther behind, but they don't want to lose the freedom to do that either. And perhaps most importantly, all these companies, they have international markets. They sell hardware and software around the world. And part of their international credibility and ability to sell their products internationally, depends on them being perceived as neutral and not a U.S. government surveillance proxy, I think that's one of the many issues here that I think is pushing the other tech companies to fall behind Apple. But I think it's an important and very legitimate one.
We have 1 minute left. Time goes so fast,
yeah.
I do want to have another show where we'll have more time. But Stephen Rombaum, I want to just ask you about that point that Brian Ford is making. These companies want to sell their products overseas. And since the Snowden revelations, the whole world suspects that everything they do with U.S. telecommunications companies or computer companies or technology companies will just be a backdoor for NSA spying. Is that a driving force in this?
I agree with every word of that. And I'll tell you further, it's a slippery slope. Because if Apple unlocks this phone for the U.S. government, they have no argument left when the Chinese government asks them to unlock it, or the Libyan government, or the Iranian government, or the Russian government. I think Apple is taking a very principled stand. I think it is a marketing issue for them, which is not exactly the moral high ground. But, Let them do the right thing for the wrong reason.
We're going to have to leave it there. We have been joined by Stephen Rombaum and by Brian Ford. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump's rallies are being met with resistance and protest everywhere he travels. With the Arizona primary taking place tonight, as well as the Utah caucus, we will speak with one of the activists who attended the protest and helped organize the protest against Donald Trump over the weekend in Arizona. We are joined from Arizona by Carlos Garcia. Welcome, Carlos.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what happened? I mean, that your action against Trump, that caught the attention of the media, not just in the United States, but all over the world. Just tell us what actually happened.
So what happened last Saturday is we wanted to shut down Trump. We wanted to shut down his hate rhetoric. We wanted to shut his rally down. And so what we decided to do was close the both of the freeways that led to the rally. And some folks took a rest, and we were able to shut down at least for 3 or 4 hours the entire rally.
I mean, what specific tactics did you use to create that kind of congestion? How did you stop that traffic?
Yeah, so there was actually two actions that were done. There was two ways into this town where Donald Trump was going to speak. And so on one side, we actually used vehicles. So we stopped vehicles in the middle of the road. People got out, and we created a rally at that point. And on the other end, on the other entrance, we had a larger amount of people. We had 500 or 600 people. And then those folks decided to actually take over the street. And so with both of those tactics, we were able to kind of hold traffic for about 3 hours.
And what happened inside the rallies? I mean, this was another place where Donald Trump comes and rallies. A lot of people come to support Trump in his message, which is anti-immigrant, build a wall, make Mexico pay for the wall. And also, as protesters are being let out, invariably, they are being physically attacked, you know, assaulted by Trump supporters. Talk about what happened inside.
Yeah, so there was two rallies that happened in Arizona on Saturday. The one where I was at was in Phoenix, and we were actually successfully able to keep the rally very small. They were expecting upwards of 20 to 30,000 people, and they had probably a couple of thousand there. But down in Tucson, which is about an hour and a half south of Phoenix, we saw people once again being physically abused. They were being punched. They were being kicked. They were being pushed, like we've seen in the past. And one of the reasons in Phoenix we decided not to concentrate or focus our action inside the event was for that same reason, because Sheriff Arpaio in Arizona is who was policing the event. And then we also saw how hateful and violent Trump supporters have been in the past. And so that's why that was part of why we decided to shut down the roadways instead of going and facing that violence there.
So rather than going into the lion's den where you would ultimately be mauled by the lion because the lion has so many more forces, you took a different route. You blocked traffic, and you say you as many as 15,000 people then who would have come to the Trump rally didn't come because of the traffic congestion. Let me ask you, what happened afterwards? Were people arrested? Was there a big backlash? Was there repression against you and the other activists?
Yeah, so the way you put it, our strategy was to keep the lions away from the den. And so if the lions couldn't get there and hear the Donald Trump message, then that was going to be successful for us. Three people were actually arrested. One of the persons, Jacinta Gonzalez, is all three that were arrested were citizens, but she has a Latino surname. She was actually sent over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So we had three people arrested. There's two allies that participated. They were released that same night, but Jacinta was sent over to Immigration and kept until the next day.
So she was sent to Immigration even though she's a U.S. citizen?
Yes, she's a U.S. citizen. And they decided to put what they called an ICE hold, which anytime someone is arrested and they suspect this person to not have documents, they put a hold on them and don't release them and then send them over to Immigration. And that's what happened with Jacinta.
And the only possible way that they could suspect that she was not a citizen was by the nature of her name. She has a Spanish surname.
That was it. That was the only way that they could suspect that. And not only did they suspect, but they acted on it. And I think that's why it was so important for us last Saturday in Arizona to push back on Donald Trump, because what Donald Trump is saying is not new to us. We've heard it before by, you know, the sheriff that we have here, by the previous governor, Jan Brewer. And we've heard this hateful rhetoric, and we've also seen it put into practice. And the ways we've seen it put into practice is by racial profiling, detention and deportation of our people. And once again, this year, seeing it be put into law at the state legislature.
Today is the primary in Arizona. What do you expect today?
I think today here in Arizona, we expect probably Donald Trump to win. I feel like this is the kind of place where he would thrive on the Republican side. The community here in Arizona is very divided. You're either with Sheriff Joe Arpaio and Donald Trump, or you're with the immigrant community. And so I think in Arizona, like we've seen in other places, we could probably expect Donald Trump to win. But once again, our community is not going to stand idle while this happens. We have a rally tomorrow at the state capitol. This hatred that Donald Trump is spewing has actually provoked the state legislature to push 8 anti-immigrant bills. Mind you, in the last 6 years since SB 1070, we haven't seen one anti-immigrant bill. And now that this rhetoric is coming back, that Donald Trump is taking off, we're once again having to fight for our lives at the state legislature.
Everywhere Trump rallies now, there seems to be growing protest. In the beginning, there were a few voices. They would get pummeled. They would be dragged out. Trump would say, hey, in the good old days, we'd take him out on a stretcher, or he got what he asked for, or, you know, something like that. But then in Chicago, when Trump came into downtown Chicago, the University of Illinois, thousands and thousands of young people, mostly students, came out and protested. And it was Latinos, and it was black people and white people and Asian, Arab, I mean, across religious faiths. It was a big thing. And that seemed to me to be, and I want you to give your own opinion, your own evaluation of it. It signaled all the people who are activists and who oppose Trump or support immigrants that something really major could be done. Were you inspired by what happened in Chicago? Did that help you guys make a decision about what you were going to do?
We were most definitely inspired by what happened in Chicago. And I think to see the diversity and the level of organizing that happened in Chicago was really impressive. And I think Trump's going to face that, especially in communities that are organized. The Black Lives Matter movement, the anti-police brutality movement has been strong, diverse, and growing in Chicago. And I think those same forces then came together recognizing that Donald Trump was just as much of a threat as anybody else, and they had to come together. And in the same way here in Arizona, the kind of pro-immigrant, anti-racist organizing that we've been doing for years, we're better equipped and available to put together actions like the one we did last Saturday. And I hope that this inspires and continues across the country, because once again, this might sound like just campaign rhetoric now, but in places like Arizona, it's very real, and we've heard it before, and it could quickly turn into policy and the continued destruction of our community.
Coming from Arizona, which in many ways has been ground zero for the attacks on immigrants, and as you said, a very divided population, a lot of anti-immigrant bias, a lot of just straight-out white supremacy and white racism against immigrants and against Latino populations, I want to talk to you about the Trump campaign, because Trump is ranting against what he calls as the establishment. And he does have different positions than some of the establishment politicians, both the Democrats and the Republicans. For instance, on the Middle East, he says the U.S. shouldn't have gone to war against Iraq. The U.S. shouldn't have gone to war against Libya. The U.S. should have better relations with Russia. But it seems to me that that's not why his base of support from below, the white people especially who are supporting Trump, that's not what's galvanizing them in the anti-establishment message. It's not his foreign policy. It's really this almost naked embrace of white supremacy or hostility to immigrants, especially. When you interact with the Trump supporters, what are you getting?
They're pissed off just as much as anyone. I think you see a really angry group of people that are looking to make their lives better or to figure out what went wrong. And unfortunately, what Trump is kind of preaching is that somehow what they need is in the back or is behind us somewhere. And when he says make America great again, to us, that means segregation, that means slavery, that means colonization, that means a lot of things that hurt our communities for a really long time. And so I think what's hitting or what's getting these folks is that they are mad. They're mad with the establishment. They might not have jobs. They might not like where things are going. But I think what's wrong is to once again scapegoat immigrants or scapegoat communities of color as the ones that are at fault for these folks not being satisfied. And so, like them, we might not be satisfied with the way the establishment or current government is functioning, but to blame us, immigrants or people of color, for all your faults is the problem. And it goes to that xenophobia. And it's kind of the easy target that we've seen throughout history to scapegoat immigrants and scapegoat people of color as those who cause you all the harm.
Let me ask you on the other side of the aisle about the Democratic Party, because we have Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders both running. Now, Hillary Clinton is sort of wrapping herself in the mantle of the Obama administration as she attempts to especially reach out and get African-American votes, trying to gain votes where Sanders might be weaker. Maybe people in the black community don't know Sanders as well. In the South, the Democratic machine is strong, and it's strong within the black community and is able to mobilize the black community behind the preferred candidate of Hillary Clinton. But when Clinton wraps herself in the mantle of Obama and says, I will be the extension of Obama's policies, from the point of view of the immigrant communities, the Obama administration, while it's made some major concessions in the recent years, there's also been a record number of deportations of undocumented people during the last 7 years. Talk about how you think this will play within the Latino community in Arizona.
Yeah, so I think very similar to the African American community, there's kind of two polars that are happening, and it's kind of the established black and the established Latino electorate or class. And then you have this grassroots younger groups of folks, and you're seeing it also play out in these candidates where some of the younger folks, the folks that have been more active, are supporting Bernie, and then some of the establishment folks, you know, the civil rights leader like Dolores Huerta and others might be supporting Hillary Clinton. I think for us, after the kind of disappointment after Obama deporting 3 million people, and then if we go back to the Bill Clinton administration, we see a lot of the laws that are allowing for our people to be deported actually came out of that administration. And so for us, I mean, at least speaking for Puente and a lot of the immigrant rights community in Arizona, it's hard to pick a side. I mean, it's hard to once again believe or have hope with all the promises that were made by President Obama of immigration reform and then turning around and deporting more people than any other president in the history. And so for us, it's hopefully we learn that lesson. And whoever the candidate is on the Democratic or Republican side, our job is to tell the stories of our people, tell the stories of the suffering, organize, and hopefully push the issue enough so that some real action can happen.
What about Donald Trump as president? What do you think that would mean for immigrant and Latino and immigrant communities inside of Arizona? Or everywhere?
I mean, again, I think for people in Arizona, we've been living with Donald Trump. We've been living with governors that think like Donald Trump, with sheriffs that think like Donald Trump, and we've survived. We resisted. We've been resilient. A lot of our people have been deported. A lot of people have gone to other places. But I think what it will do if it happens, I'm not saying I taking him at his word, and if he puts into effect the plans of getting rid of all of us or building this wall, we're going to have to organize and stand up like we have against the previous people that thought like him.
After your action where you blocked traffic and created such mayhem for people who were trying to go to the Trump rally, how were you received within your own community? I mean, people must have been shocked at the effectiveness of that action.
Yeah, I mean, I think people were excited. I think people were excited at the level of escalation. I think the amount of hatred that he's spewing by calling us rapists, by blaming us for almost all the ills of this country, hadn't met this resistance. And again, I hope and we support and we would help in other places if other folks are willing to take that same stand, because I think most of our people feel the same way, but maybe sometimes lack the organization or the ability to do something like try to shut down his rally.
In 2006, we only have 1 minute. In 2006, 12 to 13 million mostly undocumented workers surprised the country, surprised the world, surprised themselves undoubtedly when they went on a general strike that started on May Day. That was in reaction to Sensenbrenner calling immigrants Mexicans. If if Trump is elected, or if this continues, can you see a revival of that sort of mammoth 2006 type movement?
Yes, and unfortunately, it takes kind of the water being up to our necks for us to react, and we saw that happen back then. But you also saw it reflect in electoral politics. 2 years after that, the Congress and the presidency was taken by the Democratic Party. And so you also saw people say, you know, today we march, tomorrow we vote. Unfortunately, that shift in the electorate didn't turn around and help our communities. What ended up happening is in those 2 years that the Democrats had full control of Congress and the president was in office, they did nothing for us. And subsequently, 6 years after that, they deported almost 3 million people. And so I think for our community, we've seen that, we've learned from it, and I think we're gonna put pressure on a Trump administration just as much as a Hillary or a Sanders administration.
Okay, we're gonna have to leave it there. We really want to thank you, Carlos Garcia. Great action and great talking to you. We are out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.